Support for WAER Original Podcasts comes from California Closets of Syracuse, located in DeWitt. California Closets can help you get your entire home organized with custom-designed storage solutions for the home office, kitchen pantry, closets, and more. Online at californiaclosets.com.
Look, up in the sky, it's a bird, it's a plane, it's another episode of Pop Life. But don't have a cow, man. This episode won't be the usual yada yada. Instead, we'll be looking at the way pop culture influences not only what we talk about, but the way we talk. Ever notice how many phrases you utter on a daily basis are derived from some pop culture source? Whether it's, I want to go to there, from 30 Rock, or that's what she said from The Office, our everyday speech is filled with terms and phrases from popular culture. But why? Why do we use pop culture references? How do they influence our language, our relationships, even our sense of self? I'm Kendall Phillips, urging you to fasten your seat belts because it's going to be a bumpy night as we dive into the influence of pop culture on our everyday talk. Here to help us boldly go where no Pop Life episode has gone before is Dr. Sylvia Sierra, a professor in the Department of Communication and Rhetorical Studies at Syracuse University and author of Millennials Talking Media, Creating Intertextual Identities in Everyday Conversation from Oxford University Press. Sylvia, welcome to Pop Life.
Thanks so much for having me, and what a great introduction.
I think I maxed out on the number of pop culture references. I should give thanks to all my Twitter followers because I did put out a question. Because I will say, when I sat down and thought, I want to pack my intro with all kinds of pop culture references, my mind went completely blank, which I'm wondering, you know, there is a way in which pop culture references seem to kind of really organically happen.
Yeah.
Whereas when I sat down to make a list, I had to go to Twitter.
Yeah.
Is that part of how pop culture references are different than any other reference we would kind of make in everyday talk?
It's a good question. I do think there's something to the fact that they come to you, you know, in the right moment. And a lot of them are used because they're these really great phrases that sometimes are kind of vague and kind of weird or quirky, and you're able to just map them onto the situation at hand. So it's kind of hard to just think of them if you're not in a situation that calls for one. So I think that observation is probably right. And actually, I'm not really sure, you know, as far as how they're different from other references, because kind of when I think of references now, I think of all of them to some extent as being like media or pop culture related. You know, even just quoting a book or something, that's still a form of media. So, but yeah, that's an interesting point.
Yeah, it just seems like it's become such a, is it partly that it's become pop culture, whatever that means, this ubiquitous pile of stuff, mm-hmm. has become such a reference for every day that it's almost like how we understand the everyday is through The Office or Big Bang Theory or whatever it might be?
Yeah, that's interesting because, you know, and it gets us to like what's represented in the media, what kinds of experiences and people are represented, and the fact that we do, I think, to some extent, look to media for how to live our lives. As scary as that sounds, like I did see evidence of that in my book. It's almost like people looking to memes for examples as to how to like express their gender identity, for example. So, yeah, it's kind of like the dark side of this, but it has a lot of influence on our everyday lives, for sure.
And that's what I found really fascinating about your book, which I think everybody should pick up, Millennials Talking Media. But it's, you know, when you start thinking about pop culture references, you sort of say, yes, okay, there are a lot of them. I can't think of them without the moment, but in the moment, I'm sure I have them.
Right.
But it's easy to just think, well, okay, so I do that, right? And not uh-huh. think about the bigger topic or the bigger issue. So I'm curious if you would, like, how did the idea for the book come to? I know you come from a background in linguistics, so you are one always looking at kind of the way we talk.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But how did this idea come about?
So I was actually really inspired by some previous work I read that was by Ala Tavares, a linguist at in D.C., and she was looking at how people interacted with different TV quiz shows, so like Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, and how they would kind of talk to the TV maybe or talk to each other about the participants in these shows. And it really just got me, I was really interested in just that topic and found it fascinating. And I started thinking about the people who I had been recording for a while. At the time, I was just recording a bunch of conversations among my friends. I had no idea what I wanted to research at that time for my PhD dissertation. And I started, you know, thinking, well, we don't have like TVs, like being millennials, like a lot of us just didn't watch TV. But I started thinking, well, we do play a lot of video games. Like that was a huge part of the house where I did a lot of my recordings, where a group of friends lived. And so I was like, I wonder if they ever, you know, quote these video games in their everyday talk. And right away, I thought of a conversation I had recorded where they had. And then just a couple weeks later, I was lucky enough to record another one where they were quoting the Oregon Trail video game. And then after that, I kind of expanded it just to be more broad and look at all kinds of media references. And that's how I got into, you know, memes, which people seem to get very interested in that aspect of the book. But also, you know, TV shows, songs, movies, and, you know, books, like I mentioned earlier. So that's kind of how the idea came to me. It was inspiration and then just looking for what was happening in my friend group, really.
Now, I must say that for me is one of the fascinating parts of the book is the method, I suppose, which is that you recorded a small group of friends over a period of time in a variety of situations, talking about a variety of stuff, and then went back through and found that. So I'm just curious, since these were your friends, I'm fascinated to know, like, how, like, did that change the dynamic of your relationship with people? I mean, I can't imagine someone I know saying, I'm going to record you for the next, I mean, God forbid I would then be on a podcast or something. but, I mean, how did that change things with the group, or what was it like studying your friends?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, you know, for starters, I wasn't the only one who was a linguistics PhD student. So, you know, a couple of the other people I recorded were in the same program as me. So they were maybe already kind of used to this or had the idea. This is something that some linguists do, is just record conversations. And I think those participants had already done it themselves. So it wasn't that strange. And then for the other people who were not graduate students and were completely outside of this, I don't know. I guess it just had something to do with the fact that I was kind of an insider in that group, and they just knew this was something I wanted to do. They were happy to let me do it. And I did it so much, you know, like every time we hung out, that it just became almost routine. Like they didn't, you know, think about it. But there were also some participants that had previous experience in stand-up comedy or improv, and I think they actually really enjoyed it. And sometimes they even used it as this like occasion, you know, to practice their skills and to kind of show off a little bit. So it was a whole mix, you know, of people and different, I think, reactions to it. You know, it started out just like fun and whatever. And then later when I started doing some of the more critical pieces of my analysis, then that became a little bit more of a problem just because, you know, I was kind of critiquing some of the linguistic behavior of my friends. And so that got into some very ethically difficult territory and made me realize that a lot of the linguists who do these kinds of recordings among friends and family, they usually don't cross into that critical territory. And I had never really realized why, but I learned, you know, that it can be very difficult. So, you know, but they were very generous and willing to, you know, even answer questions I had about some of the references they made that maybe had some racist undertones or sexist undertones and things like that. And again, there were different reactions. Like some people were less comfortable with that and others, you know, just completely acknowledged that they knew what they were doing even was potentially racist. So, yeah, there were a lot of different reactions. And but in the end, we're pretty much all friends still. And it, you know, didn't have any negative like impact on my friendship. So I guess that's good at least.
I'm glad to hear that. It would be really depressing if you said we never talk now. We're all bitter enemies. There are a couple lawsuits waiting to be resolved. Yeah. So it is, what I think is very fascinating is, you know, it is true a group that knows each other interacts differently. I mean,
right.
I'm not telling you something
exactly.
You don't know. But all of us know, like, because you have inside jokes and just references immediately everybody knows,
right.
Or, you know, tones of voice that people are familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering about that in relation to kind of the way the pop culture references shaped or were used to shape those group dynamics. Were there particular things that pop culture references do to make us?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's a huge part of the book is that you know, these references that we draw on and that we share within a group, they say a lot about who we are, the kind of media we enjoy. And, you know, in this case, all of these friends, well, most of them were millennials. And so we had grown up with a lot of the same, you know, major media events, as I mentioned before, like playing the Oregon Trail. That was a huge part of all our childhoods, playing that game at school on the old white, you know, Apple desktop computers. you know, we knew a lot of the same popular songs that were big when we were growing up. We just had so much in common in terms of the media that we were familiar with. And so that made it a great group to study because, yeah, a lot of those references, not all of them, were shared. Usually they were shared at least, you know, by two people. And we could get into, you know, what it looks like when people make a failed media reference where no one gets it, or maybe someone misinterprets it as something else that it wasn't actually intended to be. But yeah, overall, you know, I make arguments about how these references shape our identities as friends, as millennials, people of the same generation who have shared experiences. And then it even gets more nuanced like that in terms of what kind of gender identities are we expressing when we, you know, quote particular media. You know, whatever gender ideology, for example, is embedded in a meme or a TV show, then when we quote that, well, what is that doing for us in the moment? So there's all these different layers of identities that can come across based on the media that you're referencing.
Yeah, so much to unpack in the book, and it's full of the kind of insights that you then go to a group of friends and sit and listen and think, oh, that's that. Oh, that's that. So it really is an amazing sort of opening up our eyes to everyday talk. But I'm curious to unpack some of those as an old person, getting older every day. I found the discussion of when someone doesn't get a reference to really speak to my daily life, where I spend most of my time with 18 and 19-year-olds who are filled with pop culture references that I'm not even aware of there was a pop culture to reference, let alone the reference. So I wonder if you can talk a little about that experience of what it's like or how it gets managed when someone is clearly no longer on the inside of that reference.
Yeah, so there was one participant in the book who I believe was Gen X, I want to say. So, yeah, most of us were millennials. She was Gen X, a little bit older than us. And it was just really notable in the one conversation I recorded when she was present. We made a few references like to the Afro Man song, "Then I Got High," or "Because I Got High," I think is the song. And some other things. And she just really had no clue. And it was interesting because she didn't just kind of play along or really act. She actually asked, like, you know, like, "Then I got high." Like, she was asking, like, what we were talking about. So, and I think different individuals have different strategies, though, because there are other cases where one of the millennial friends in the book, Paula is her pseudonym, she like admitted later she didn't know a reference to the movie The Room that we were quoting. I think it was like, "You're tearing me apart, Lisa," with which Tommy Wiseau screams in that film. And she later said she didn't know it, but in the moment she kind of just laughed and like went along with it. So some people will do that. They can sense that something's being referenced, but they'll kind of just go along with it. And other people will, you know, stop the conversation and say, "What is that?" Or, "Is that a reference to something?" Which I might be guilty of because now I'm like hypersensitive to hearing them because there are these, you know, when we're talking about spoken English, there are these verbal cues that I was also able to identify that people use to kind of signal that there's something a little different here. Usually some extra stress or loudness, which kind of highlights like this is a reference. So and I think, you know, the everyday person can kind of hear that, too, probably. And that's why you get those moments where they sense something's being referenced. They don't know what, like you just said, like with your students. Right. Sometimes you might sense that something's being referenced, but you don't get it. And, you know, you might just move on or you can, you know, ask. But, yeah, different individuals respond differently to that. And, you know, it can be a bit exclusionary because while if you share the same media references, it's a form of sharing, right, and creating this group cohesion. If you're outside of that group and not getting it, then that can feel a little bit exclusionary as well. So there's kind of the two sides to that dynamic.
Which gets back to another topic you were mentioning earlier, which is the I guess, the ideologies that are carried with it, because those memes are not innocent. They carry with them gender ideas or even the kinds of media we're engaging with are probably based on aspects of our identity. So is that part of, I guess, the ways in which that exclusion builds beyond just a small group of friends and you all laugh and I either awkwardly stare or I laugh with you not knowing what's going on? That's a microcosm of that. But then I guess it has bigger ramifications if my sense of culture is no longer included in a broader sense of culture.
Yeah, that could definitely be the case. you know, even some of the more problematic references that were made in the conversations I recorded, I had the sense, and I think I also asked the participants in a form of playback interview where I would play back the conversations to them and ask them their reactions to it, that some of those references would not have been made, for example, if they hadn't been like in a predominantly white space at the time. Like if there had been a person of color present, they wouldn't have made a certain kind of reference. And then there's something to be said, too, about there's some theorizing about humor and that it kind of blunts your critical sensitivity and that you're kind of more willing to take risks when you make jokes. Actually, this is something that is even taught sometimes, like in improv acting, to just do the risky thing, make the racist joke just for the sake of laughs. So sometimes I think people kind of set aside their critical awareness just to get some laughs in the moment, even if they sense there's something a little wrong there. But yeah, it could certainly exclude someone who doesn't think that joke is funny, right, or doesn't reflect their experience. And I mean, there were even times in the conversation where I'm kind of uncomfortable at certain references being made and I just don't say much or, you know, change the subject. So that can definitely be part of it as well.
That's interesting. I guess I'm wondering, I don't remember this being a specific issue in the examples that you talk about in the book, but, you know, how people would manage that boundary. Like, you know, there's a point where either through cultural appropriation or just language that doesn't feel comfortable, at one level, it's a joke, we're friends, we all know the reference, mm-hmm. but are there strategies, I guess, or are there ways that that can be managed within a group in a productive way?
It's a great question. I'm not sure if I have the answer. You know, I do think just raising people's awareness about it makes them a little more, you know, just it makes you think about it more. Because the problem really is the media itself. Like there's so many stereotypes and, you know, messed up ideologies in the media. It's kind of like the tool that we're given. And then when we quote our favorite little bits of that, we're not often thinking, you know, about all the I think it's so insidious that it just like sneaks its way into our conversations a lot of the time and we're not even aware. And it takes, you know, an analyst like me to peel back all those layers and be like, well, what does this meme actually say about sexuality and relationships and gender roles? But I do think once you raise awareness, like in a friend group, they, you know, it might have some differences. And actually, I even saw that with a kind of a different group of friends. I talk about this in the book later. We were talking about one of the more racist references that had been made previously. And someone makes that reference again. But right afterwards, they say like, oh, don't say that. That's racist. So I think there is room for like raising that kind of awareness, and then that could affect maybe the friend, you know, group dynamic. But I think like in your everyday sense, most people just aren't aware enough to really think about that. But you never know. I mean, it's also very, you know, like face threatening to call someone out.
Sure.
In the moment, you know, for using a certain word or, you know, a reference or something that you might realize has some kind of problematic background, and maybe the person who used it didn't. So there's kind of an issue with that, too, and reasons why in the moment people just tend to go with things and don't actually raise these issues.
Yeah, it seems similar to the issue of when the group tells a joke I don't get mm-hmm. and I laugh, because you're right, they signal with their voice or their intonation or uh-huh. whatever. I say, okay, I get that's a reference that's meant to be funny. Everyone's laughing. I'll laugh along. Or mm-hmm. someone raises something and people laugh and I say, I would probably not laugh at that, but
right.
for the sake of. So I'm wondering, you know, that I guess in some ways that becomes part of the core issue is the way these pop culture references kind of shape us.
Yeah.
And that calling those into question or pulling those out and saying, no, or I don't get that is a moment of saying, maybe I'm not us.
Yeah, it's such a fascinating thing when you start looking at it closely. There's just so many layers there. And, you know, I certainly, when I was in these conversations as a participant myself, I know I wasn't thinking about all these issues. But yeah, it's like after the fact, when you reflect on it and see it there, then you're starting to kind of question like, wow, like, is that what I think? Or, you know, is that what I believe? Or is that how I, you know, do I want to live my life according to this meme and what it tells me about femininity, you know? So, yeah, it's a fascinating topic.
Yeah, I guess I'm also wondering about, you know, as – and this is something that seems to be part of the analysis you do, that as a – so a group takes, like, something from the Oregon Trail or the game Papers, Please, which I did not know, so I was interested to read about.
It's a bit niche.
And they take that, and then at some point – does it become more the group's language than the references language? Like, it seems there's a point where this now functions in a way that we get because we've used it. And maybe even someone that knows the game would come in and say, I know the reference, but I don't quite see why that's funny or why you would say that in that instance.
Yeah, I've seen so many permutations, you know, like even within my own family, it's like there'll be a reference we have and then someone glues on another reference to that. And now it's like this totally different thing that no one outside the family would understand. We've just glued two different events together and now that's the reference. And yeah, one thing I loved about doing this research was seeing how people would take these, say something from the Oregon Trail, and they'd map it onto a real life experience and they'd tweak parts of it. So, you know, they actually quite rarely, I mean, sometimes you will just repeat verbatim what the phrase is, but more often people would change pieces of it. So, for example, with the Oregon Trail, like you'll see a screen that says like, Ashley has a broken leg. And in this case, they were making fun of me for a mild head injury I had on a camping trip. And they were like, Sylvia has a concussion. So, you know, they're changing pieces of it. And in that sense, yeah, over time, that can take on a life of its own. And, you know, sometimes people would just even start talking in like a character's voice, for example, from Papers, Please. And there was almost no relation anymore to like the original event that was being talked about. They're just completely in that video game now. And yeah, so there's all kinds of permutations it can take where you either drift further away from the real life event or or the reference just takes on a new meaning. There's all kinds of ways it can go.
Yeah, it feels like, I guess to put a slightly more positive spin on it, because at one level you could think, oh my goodness, our language is controlled by this mass media that's feeding us with these, you know, horrible ideologies, all of which is true. But then there's also, you know, from the book, even the examples you were talking about, instances where we take that intertextual language, like this use of all these other media texts, and yet we still have an ability as a group to transform it and change it into something that's kind of uniquely ours.
Exactly. Yeah, I think there's a hugely creative component to it. And especially when I first started looking at the video game references, you know, a lot of people get kind of like made fun of, you know, playing video games. It's a waste of time. It's stupid, you know, like you're rotting your brain. But what I found in these conversations where people were drawing on these video game experiences to actually negotiate some really difficult points in conversation, like actually, you know, a big part of the book is looking at why people use media references in the first place. And they often use them at almost these strategic moments to smooth over some awkwardness in the conversation. And this is often when maybe, you know, at least one person doesn't have the same access to knowledge as the other group members. And so there's like this a bit of a, I guess you could say, a split or something and who knows what. Or maybe there's kind of an unpleasant topic being talked about, like going back to the example of me hitting my head on this camping trip. It's kind of, you know, unpleasant and awkward. And people will often recruit a video game reference or whatever kind of reference to manage that and to kind of smooth it over, reference something that everyone does know about and something everyone can bond about. I found that just kind of remarkable that people have that kind of cognitive flexibility and creativity to pull on these past media events and to use them to do this complex interactional work in the moment.
And it seems like in most of those examples, we're using something from our shared pop culture reference library, our little archive of stuff, to lighten the mood, to smooth over something, to make things. Are there examples the other way, or do pop culture references usually lend us to something lighter? Are there examples where you'd use the pop culture? I mean, I can't think of an example. It seems like everything I think of is, you know, if I say, Houston, we have a problem, it may be acknowledging there's a problem.
Yeah.
But it's really trying to, like, say,
make
ha,
light
ha.
Of it. Yeah. I can't really think of it being used in the opposite way. Not that, you know, it couldn't. But yeah, I think usually when people draw on these, it is because they're fun and it's used to make light of something. I can't really think of drawing on one that would, for the sake of making a situation worse than it already is. But I suppose it's possible.
No, it seems like, and maybe that's one of the functions that pop culture as an external reference is, it gives us that horizon of something. And I guess most of these pop culture references are relatively light. Like, people are not making pop culture references to some grim story on PBS or something. Right. Like, it's always like, you know, a video game, a meme, et cetera, as a way of sort of lightening the mood. I was wondering, you know, as I was reading through, and again, many of the references are new to me as an old person. Did you find any difference from in the source of the reference? Like, this, I know there's a lot of conversation about memes, but are meme references different than, say, television references or video game references? Are there any qualitative difference, or do they all kind of end up being used more or less the same smoothing process?
I mean, there are some differences because, for example, in a film, a TV show, or video game, you have room for a lot more complexity than, say, a meme. So you can have, you know, a whole cast of characters that have all these life events, and there's a lot more there that you can draw from and that you can do with in a conversation. So, for example, another reference in the book is to the Disney Beauty and the Beast song, Belle. There's a lot going on in that song, and so there's a whole extended singing sequence where they're mapping that onto someone, kind of making fun of Paula again in the group for drinking gin and tonic alone, and saying, you know, like, oh, there goes that girl, she's drinking gin and tonic. So that's a whole sequence that happens. But with a meme, they're so limited, you know. Usually if there's any text at all, it's just like a simple phrase or something, and there's just one image. So there's less you can do sometimes with a meme reference, although there are – sometimes there's like series of memes. So actually there's this whole meme about skipping leg day at the gym and how you know, like friends don't let friends skip leg day. And then there's other associated memes with that, like, bro, do you even lift? So sometimes when there's similar memes like that, you can do a little more with them. But I do think like those are a bit more limited. Whereas, yeah, it's just kind of the more you have to work with, the more you can do with it. So, yeah, I think that answers that question.
No, very much so. And I'm also curious, of course, as the old person in the room, which I've probably mentioned a few times during this episode, now, again, your focus is very much on this group of millennials, and it's a great deep dive into the use of pop culture references, millennials talking media. But I'm wondering to ask you to step out, since I know you encounter older people, including me, on a fairly regular basis. Do you sense a generational shift? Like, are pop culture references more plentiful or maybe more rapidly changing for this younger generation and probably even the next generation, whatever's after you all, the even younger millennials? Do you feel like the pop culture references are changing in their quality, their use in everyday talk?
I think what you said is right, that there's more to draw on, you know, from now than ever before. So, you know, if you go way back, you know, when people were, you know, we have evidence of people like writing letters, right, before we recorded, you know, conversation or interactions. And there, you know, they might quote like something from the Bible or their favorite novel, but it was kind of limited. And over time, you know, with the advent of radio and television, right, there's more to draw from. So, for example, you know, the boomer generation might quote more films or TV shows. They're probably not going to quote so many video games or maybe memes. And then, you know, there's different kinds of music that I guess people from all generations can quote, but that's going to vary based on what you're listening to. And then, yeah, I do think with the newer generation, and I've already started looking into Generation Z, you know, our students basically, and how they use media references. But yeah, there's just a broader variety. And they might still quote some of that old stuff. Like, people still tend to quote some really well-known lines from books and things like that. But now there's just so much more and so much newer. And it's an interesting question as to whether it's changing more rapidly. I guess I could kind of see that because, you know, I'll notice myself, for example, like, I've gotten into watching TikToks. And I might quote something a few times from a TikTok, but probably after a while, like, I'll forget about it or move on to something else, you know? So, yeah, that's an interesting question I haven't really looked into, is like maybe the shelf life of some of these and how quickly they might change, especially now with, you know, it's not like we just have films and movies, but TikToks are like these very short videos that are just so quick, and you just look at one after the next. You know, you can look at a whole bunch within like a half an hour. So, yeah, that's a great question.
Yeah, I'm wondering as well, I think about, again, my old generation where everybody watched the same three television channels. And so if you wanted to quote MASH, everybody would know you were quoting MASH because everyone was watching MASH. But now when you get so much more, so rapid, and so much kind of narrow casting so that, you know, everybody's sort of ending up in like a little media microcosm of their own. I'm wondering if that, I mean, that probably increases the affinity of a small group of people, but I wonder if you're making it harder for outsiders to join the group when there's maybe less of that media shared language to sort of lighten the mood and ease over things.
Yeah, it could be. Because I do think along with the fact that there's so much out there, it's like certain groups can coalesce around their own specific thing that they're really into. It's like a niche topic that a small group can get into and maybe, broader society doesn't, you know, really get into that as much. So, yeah, that's another aspect of it, I think, that, you know, there are these broader things that more people know about. And then there's these very niche things that certain groups will only use. And it's interesting, you know, when people read the book to see who actually recognizes which references and which ones don't they. And like you mentioned that video game Papers, Please, that was like a very niche game that I think it came out in like 2013. And I mean, it was popular probably amongst video game playing nerds. But yeah, outside of that, you know, or people who weren't playing video games at that time probably never heard of that game. So some of them are going to be more niche like that, and then some are going to be more general and maybe will be around a little bit longer as a result, too.
Well, speaking of pop culture niches, as regular listeners of Pop Life will know, not only do we like to bring in experts, renowned folks like yourself to talk about your area of expertise and your academic work, we also like to dig into your niche, like what you're listening to and what you're digging in. As folks will know at home, we usually begin this segment with a game we call the Fast Five. So, Sylvia, I'm going to ask you five questions drawn from references studied in Millennials Talking Media. These are either-or questions. Follow your heart and go with your first response. So question number one for you, Sylvia. If you had to live out your remaining years trapped inside a video game, would it be Minecraft or the Oregon Trail?
Oh, definitely Minecraft.
You'd live longer. Like, I feel like everything in Oregon Trail just leads to
death.
Yeah.
Dysentery and death.
Yeah, whereas Minecraft, you just mine to craft and craft to mine. I like that. So question number two, mixing our memes, if you'll forgive me, are you overly attached to leg day, or does your long hair simply not care?
I'm going to go with long hair, don't care.
I'm with you. Leg day is definitely skipped in my routine on a regular basis. Once I get a routine, I'm sure I'll skip it. Question number three. Would you rather sit down for a cup of coffee with Fezzik, the giant from The Princess Bride, or Dr. Frankenfurter, the mad scientist from the Rocky Horror Picture Show? Who are you going to share a cup of Java with?
Oh, that is a really hard one. I might have to say Dr. Frankenfurter just because I love that actor so much.
Frankenfurter is a party. I think wherever Frankenfurter goes, something fun is going to happen. Question number four. When you settle down for some comfort television watching, even though as a millennial you don't watch, but let's assume one day you decide to sit down and relax with television, is it more likely to be Seinfeld or The Big Bang Theory?
Oh, definitely Seinfeld.
Definitely. It holds up. It's surprisingly
it does. I never got into The Big Bang Theory.
Gotcha. Finally, question number five, the end of our Fast Five game. If aliens land and want you to give them one object of pop culture to best represent humanity, would it be Tommy Wiseau's The Room or Gene Roddenberry's original Star Trek?
Oh, man, that's hard. I don't know Star Trek that well. I feel like The Room is a horrible portrayal of human behavior and not accurate at all. But I also think it reveals something really deep about us as human beings and what doesn't work for us. So I guess I'll go with The Room.
I feel like Star Trek is what we wish we were, and The Room is probably at the end of the long day what we actually are.
Exactly.
Sylvia, talk to us a little about what you're listening, playing into these days. Like, what's on your pop culture agenda?
So I was thinking about this a little bit when you told me this would come up. I have kind of a guilty pleasure right now of reading the Outlander series and watching the show. So it's like this time travel, romance, historical fiction blend. So I've been doing a lot of that. Nice escape from reality. And as for music, I was thinking about music as well. I've been playing drums for the past couple of years, and I'm really trying to increase my tempo. So I'm listening to and playing to a lot of fast-paced rock songs right now. So like the Ramones, Blitzkrieg Bop, and the B-52s, Private Idaho, stuff like that. So I'm just listening to a lot of this like really fast-paced pop and rock music to try to get my tempo up.
That's fabulous. I like punk and Outlander as a kind of double feature for the day.
Yeah, very eclectic.
Sylvia Sierra's book is Millennials Talking Media. It is a fascinating dive into the way pop culture references are used in our everyday talk. And to our listeners, I'll remind you, I'm Kendall Phillips. When it comes to pop culture, I'm your Huckleberry. I hope to see you back next time for a really big show. And until then, hey, let's be careful out there. That's all, folks.
Thanks for listening to Pop Life, a production of WAER, Syracuse Public Media. You can find archived episodes at WAER.org. And don't forget to subscribe in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen for automatic delivery of new episodes.